This program is intended for a print-impaired audience and is brought to you by Audio Journal. Welcome to the Massachusetts State House News Service, providing our listeners with high-quality, comprehensive, objective information about the activities of our state government. Today, we are covering the week of May 11th through 17th, 2026. This program is sponsored by the Memorial Foundation for the Blind and the Massachusetts Commission for the Blind. This is Paula Simchak. Advocates say thousands of jobs are expected to get cut unless lawmakers restore funding for a program that supports employment for at-risk young people. The current state budget includes $15.24 million for a line item supporting a jobs program for at-risk youth. That funding is expected to provide 3,800 youth summer jobs this year, according to state officials. That's down from 6,500 jobs funded by $23 million in fiscal 2025, $16.24 million in legislative appropriations, and the rest from unspent or unobligated funding from previous years and unspent ARPA funds. Youth advocates are calling on senators to boost funding during next week's budget debate. They are backing a Senator Sal DiDomenico amendment that raises the Senate Ways and Means Committee's allocation of almost $15.4 million to $20 million. This is enough to add back 1,150 jobs, said Lewis Finfer of the Youth Jobs Coalition and Massachusetts Action for Justice. About $25 million is needed to fund the 6,000 jobs that advocates desire, but that ask didn't seem politically feasible in a tight budget year, Finfer said. The House-approved fiscal 2027 budget funds the program at about $17.6 million. Governor Maura Healey's budget proposal matches the Senate's at almost $15.4 million. During a rally held in a packed hearing room at the State House, Senator Jamie Eldridge of Marlborough backed the amendment, noting he represents a district where fewer families rely on youth jobs for additional income. Eldridge said he was motivated to support the funds after learning about the different challenges young people face in areas where they feel more pressured to get a job and support their family. "It really moves me to advocate for these programs," he said. For Amani Henry, who migrated to the U.S. 2 years ago, job opportunities and support he's received from the youth organization Mission Safe are crucial to helping his mom back in Jamaica. "This is my only way to help my family at the moment, and I know there are plenty of kids who need these types of programs for many other reasons," Henry said. ARPA funds have been exhausted, and Healey launched other programs aimed at support youth workers, the Executive Office of Labor and Workforce Development said. This includes a program that provides $900,000 to six organizations for job training, placement, and other services for 116 young adults with disabilities. Hundreds of Mass General Brigham workers plan to vote next week on whether to authorize a strike as bargaining discussions with the state's largest health system have stalled. Since March 2025, about 450 Mass General Brigham home care clinicians say they have participated in 26 bargaining sessions to secure their first contract with the health system. In June 2024, the clinicians voted to join the Massachusetts Nurses Association. If the clinicians authorize a strike, the bargaining committee could call a strike of up to 7 days. It doesn't mean a strike will definitely be scheduled or held. In March, clinicians held an informal picket outside Massachusetts General Hospital, calling on the health system to meet their requests. And the nurses' union says that system profits, executive pay, and bonuses suggest that MGB can't afford the workers' requests. "Our clinicians want to reach a fair agreement that allows us to continue providing the high-quality care our patients deserve," Mass General Brigham Home Care Registered Nurse and Mass Nurses Association Chair Shannon Vieira said in a statement. "This vote is about showing MGB that clinicians are united and serious about securing a contract that respects our work and protects patient care." The bargaining unit included registered nurses, occupational therapists, physical therapists, speech-language pathologists, social workers, and dietitians. They have outlined several requests, including more competitive pay, as well as recruitment and retention protections, clearer expectations that acknowledge the time needed to care for patients and to coordinate and document those services, and more reasonable caseload limits. Mass General Brigham said the health system remains committed to bargaining in good faith on a first contract for the home care bargaining unit. Also, there has been meaningful progress at the table that included wage increases, improved wage scales, and enhanced pay provisions. Additional bargaining sessions are scheduled, and our focus remains on reaching an agreement that recognizes our employees' contributions and supports the high-quality care our patients depend on, the healthcare company said in a statement sent by a spokesperson to the news service. The vote is planned for May 19th at multiple sites, with voting scheduled to conclude by 7 p.m. Patients and providers in Massachusetts will soon face fewer insurance hassles as they navigate the healthcare system, with the state newly finalizing regulations to scrap prior authorization requirements on a bevy of routine services. The regulations take effect on June 5th, although patients might not see benefits until the end of the year. Insurance Commissioner Michael Calju said Thursday that guidance for implementing the changes is being distributed to insurance companies, doctors, patient advocacy organizations, and consumer groups. The Division of Insurance will also hold sessions about navigating the reforms through June and July, Calju said at a press conference at the Dana-Farber Cancer Institute that brought together oncologists and other medical providers, insurance leaders, cabinet secretaries, and healthcare advocates. Then we will ask our insurance companies that we license and regulate to file with us compliance or implementation plans on the rules themselves, Calju said. We will review those plans. It will be, in some cases, a strenuous review. It will be, in some cases, a strenuous review in terms of the ticking and tying to the information that's needed to be shown in those plans. By the end of the year, Calju predicted patients and clinicians will benefit from the insurance overhaul. Governor Maura Healey unveiled the proposed reforms in mid-January, with a focus on prohibiting prior authorization requirements for emergency and urgent care, primary care, chronic care, occupational and physical therapy, and certain prescription drugs. A federal health webpage says people should head straight to the hospital in an emergency, and that insurers cannot require patients to get prior approval before accessing emergency room services from a provider or hospital that's out of network. Based on public comments, the final regulations also nix prior authorization for radiology imaging used after a cancer diagnosis and ensure that approval for chronic conditions like cancer continues for the entire course of treatment, Healey's office said. Substance use disorder services and reproductive care, including abortions, will not be subject to prior authorization either, Healey said. During a February hearing, some insurers cautioned the reforms could worsen already rising health care costs. Laura Pellegrini, CEO of the Massachusetts Association of Health Plans, said Thursday that prior authorization is still an important tool for managing costs. MAHP member plans are all in on finding solutions to the Commonwealth's affordability crisis and have invested heavily in automation, electronic prior authorization, and standardized processes that reduce burden and improve access to care, Pellegrini said in a statement. But administrative reforms alone will not lower premiums or make healthcare more affordable. Those efforts must be paired with meaningful action to address the underlying drivers of cost growth, including rising hospital prices, outpatient facility costs, and prescription drug spending. Chuck Straven, a Dana-Farber patient, reflected on the insurance hurdles he encountered a few years ago when his oncologist recommended a treatment plan to slow his rapidly progressing kidney cancer. Instead of moving immediately to treatment, we entered a long process of paperwork, appeals, and delays with my insurance company, ultimately to be denied, and then desperately searching for a different path, Straven said. Ironically enough, studies show that patients like me with advanced disease experience greater prior authorization delays. That makes no sense. The updated regulations also require insurers to respond to urgent requests within 24 hours and honor existing approvals for at least 90 days when patients switch health plans. Disease progression does not wait, Straven said. Patients in crisis cannot afford delays of days or weeks and cannot afford to manage that uncertainty. Healey said the prior authorization reforms will help manage cost pressures, but the regulatory relief comes as her administration and the legislature have yet to produce solutions to tackle health care affordability woes. The governor did not directly answer a question about expected cost savings from the revised regulations and the impact on people's premiums. Well, let me offer this. Time is stress, Healey said. Time is stress for patients, for their family members. Time is health, because delays impact people's health. Time is sometimes life or death. And yes, time is money. Earlier Thursday, as the Massachusetts Health Connector Board voted on affordability schedules tied to the individual mandate, Calju offered a sobering take on the insurance landscape. I just wanted to note that I think the work here is more important than ever, Calju said. Insurance is increasingly out of reach and unsustainable for not just the individuals that benefit from the subsidies that are put forward through our work here and the state support, but increasingly across the market. And our work to reduce those costs systemically have taken on an urgency that we have never seen in Massachusetts. Seeking to safeguard access to preventive health services, state regulators agreed Thursday to maintain existing federal standards to avoid any negative impacts that might be caused by shifting guidance from Washington. The Massachusetts Health Connector Board voted to lock in federally defined preventive services as of July 1, 2025. Officials expressed concern about a shakeup to the U.S. Preventive Services Task Force and the potential for subsequent clinical recommendations that could erode access to care. Massachusetts has already disentangled itself from federal vaccine policy after U.S. Health and Human Services Secretary Robert Kennedy Jr. terminated all members of the Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices. Governor Maura Healey and state health officials have rebuked recommendations from Kennedy's new appointees, including around COVID-19 and measles shots. The state's minimum creditable coverage standards, which outline the scope of insurance coverage that residents need to comply with the individual insurance mandate or face a tax penalty, rely on the federal definition of preventive health services to identify which types of no-cost care Bay Staters should have, said Michael Canella, the Health Connector's Assistant General Counsel. There have been some concerning developments, both as a matter of case law and federal administration policy actions, that have called into question the reliability of this legal mechanism in federal law that assumes that these clinical bodies will make evidence-based recommendations that will then carry the force of law, Canella said. The U.S. Department of Health and Human Services last month began accepting nominations for the Preventive Services Task Force, seeking physician specialists in areas like anesthesiology, pain management, cardiology, endocrinology, family medicine, gastroenterology, hematology, oncology, internal medicine, obstetrics and gynecology, pediatrics, preventive medicine, and radiology. HHS says it's also looking for health economic experts and people with rural medicine expertise. New members are expected to start in July. The task force typically meets 3 times a year, but its last meeting was in March 2025, according to CNN. Canella said the regulatory change looks to ensure that preventive health services are available without cost sharing, so that folks can actually get access to the care that we think is beneficial to them without cost barriers. The change will align with the 2027 tax year, he said. Public Health Commissioner Dr. Robbie Goldstein filed written testimony in support of the regulatory change, saying it would preserve access to services for roughly 5.5 million adult residents. Shifting federal guidance creates a risk that carriers could narrow their preventive benefit offerings, potentially reducing access to immunizations, screenings, and other evidence-based services critical to the health of Massachusetts residents, Goldstein said. The proposed amendment addresses this risk by establishing a floor that maintains clear, consistent expectations for carriers across all market segments. The commissioner said that scaled-down preventive benefits, should they be rolled out, would disproportionately affect communities of color, low-income residents, and people managing chronic conditions. Rolling back coverage could widen existing health disparities and undermine decades of progress in areas such as immunization, cancer screening, and chronic disease prevention, Goldstein said. The Health Connector had a tumultuous 2026 open enrollment period following the expiration of federal subsidies. More federal changes will hit for 2027 open enrollment, with the One Big Beautiful Bill Act restricting the time frame for people to sign up for coverage accessed through the connector. Because federal rules will preclude us from extending open enrollment into January, we are planning to open our OE doors earlier this year, preparing for an open enrollment period this fall that will run from October 23rd to December 23rd, Connector Executive Director Audrey Morris-Gestair said. As we get closer to the fall, we look forward to keeping the board posted on our extensive outreach and education plans to help members and applicants and the public to be aware of the significant shift. The number of students missing significant school time remains well above pre-pandemic levels, though new data show absenteeism improved modestly this year. State education officials reported that 16.8% of students were chronically absent as of March 2026, meaning they missed at least 10% of school days. That marks an improvement from 19.3% in March 2025, but remains above the roughly 13% of students considered chronically absent before COVID-19 disrupted classrooms statewide. The share of students missing at least 20% of school days also fell slightly from 5.1% to 4.6%, according to the data released Friday by the Department of Elementary and Secondary Education. The figures continue a gradual recovery from the height of the pandemic, when absenteeism surged across Massachusetts and the country. In 2021, more than 35% of high school students in the state were missing at least 10% of school days, according to Boston Public Schools Superintendent Mary Skipper, who who said the problem remains especially acute in secondary schools. State officials have repeatedly warned that missing significant classroom time can have lasting academic consequences. By the time you've missed 10% of your schooling, you're going to experience academic impacts, Board of Elementary and Secondary Education member Michael Moriarty said last year. Education leaders have credited closer coordination between schools and families for the recent improvements. Acting Commissioner Russell Johnston said last year that districts have worked to engage families more successfully and create school environments where students feel that sense of connection, that sense of being known and valued. As people planning to attend FIFA World Cup matches in New York see game day bus prices slashed, Massachusetts fans are staring down round-trip commuter rail tickets to get to Foxborough at quadruple the price. The MBTA is charging $80 for round-trip commuter rail tickets on Boston Stadium trains, the only T service going directly to Gillette Stadium for the 7 World Cup matches being hosted between June 13th and July 9th. Gillette is taking on the temporary name Boston Stadium. The state was expecting over 2 million visitors in June and July for the festivities as of late April. New York Governor Kathy Hochul posted on social media Tuesday that the round-trip price of bus tickets from New York City to MetLife Stadium in New Jersey for matches would be lowered from $80 to $20. Getting to the World Cup should be as accessible as possible, Hochul wrote, announcing the price cut and adding that 20% of those tickets will be reserved exclusively for New Yorkers. Asked Thursday about Hochul's announcement and if anything like that could happen with the T, Governor Morrill Healey said, "I hadn't seen that. I'll tell you what, you know, what I decided to subsidize and provide a discount on is stuff for Massachusetts residents," Healy said. "We're going to look for other ways to save people who are using public transit as a regular matter, you know, day to day, to get to work, to get to wherever they need to get to, making that more affordable." The Healy administration in March rolled out a plan for commuter rail promotions this summer, including free Fridays and monthly pass discounts, as the state prepares for a busy sequence of major events and attempts to reduce congestion. "We looked at what we could do in terms of getting people to Gillette for the games, and I think we arrived at a good figure. It's not the most expensive way, by any means, to get to Gillette," Healy continued. "I think it's a reasonable, you know, fee for that kind of service." Hochul and the FIFA World Cup NYNJ host committee wrote in a Wednesday press release that in anticipation of increased ticket demand and at the lower price point, bus capacity will be expanded from an initial 10,000 seats to 18,000 for 5 matches and 12,000 seats for 3 matches. They've secured school buses to make it a reality and said fans who already purchased shuttle tickets will automatically get a $60 refund. New Jersey Governor Mickey Sherrill also announced this week that New Jersey Transit World Cup train tickets are being lowered to $98. The round-trip tickets were initially set at $150, according to NBC New York. The Healy administration recently launched a Kick the Drive campaign, encouraging visitors and residents to plan ahead, avoid driving when possible, and take public transportation during match days when significant increases in traffic are expected. Chief Operating Officer of Kraft Sports and Entertainment, Jim Nolan, said at a Know Before You Go press conference held Wednesday that we have significant parking, significant enough parking capacity for anyone who wants to drive to Gillette. "There are going to be more people traveling to Gillette Stadium by train and by bus than any event in the history of Gillette Stadium," Nolan said. Asked Thursday about the contradictory messaging, Healy said, "I encourage people to not drive. We're going to have a ton of people coming here, and we want the roads and travel to be as easy as possible. There are a lot of different options for folks. We're going to continue to work together on all of this," Healy said. "I think in general, you know, better to have people getting to Gillette not by their car, but through other means. And that's what we've tried to do with the program we have through the T, for example," Healy said. State public health officials said Wednesday that they're activating their World Cup emergency operations plan June 1st. Some small property owners are warning that a rent control ballot measure would put them underwater if it is approved. At the same time, communities like Somerville are desperate for housing solutions, Senator Pat Gelin told a panel of landlords on Thursday. The juxtaposition represents the crux of the debate on an initiative petition that could reach voters November 3rd that would cap annual rent increases statewide at 5% or the consumer price index, whichever is lower. Rent control bills have failed to gain favor in the decades since a 1994 voter law banned rent control in the state. "I've had people tell me, since it was first debated with the AG's office last August, that they're holding units vacant longer. They're converting to condos, and all this naturally occurring affordable housing in the Mass Landlords Network is going away already," Mass Landlords Executive Director Douglas Quattrocci said at a briefing. We really don't want this to pass, because it will go away even faster if it becomes reality. The campaign supporting the petition, Homes for All, is lauding it as a way to provide housing price stability as tenants face a persistent affordability crisis. The Supreme Judicial Court last Wednesday heard arguments in a challenge to several aspects of the petition. If the petition were to pass, Springfield small property owner Jasmine Naylor thinks she might have 5 years left as a landlord. She hasn't raised her rent in 2 years and juggles several jobs so that she doesn't pass increases on to her tenants. I know my tenants. I actually know their names. I know them because they were just like me when I was coming up, Naylor said. No landlord wants to displace, and there are bad actors, and we have to acknowledge that there are bad actors in the field, and we're not shying away from that truth. Small property owners make up 60% of rental housing in Massachusetts, opposition campaign Housing for Massachusetts Chair Connor Units said. The campaign says the policy would be the most restrictive in the country and implement a one-size-fits-all requirement statewide. It's unfortunate to be punished for someone else's misbehavior in the marketplace when the predominant number of landlords are not misbehaving in terms of the increases that they're giving, in terms of how they're maintaining their properties, in terms of the community that they are creating, providing, and supporting, Naylor added. Senator Michael Moore referred to a Center for State Policy Analysis and Greater Boston Real Estate Board study that found the proposal could shrink the residential property tax base by 6% to 9% in municipalities across the state, putting pressure on local budgets. Moore said more financial pressure on local revenues would only hurt municipalities, including those pursuing Proposition 2.5 override requests to safeguard local services. Addressing the housing crisis requires a strong partnership between government and the private sector. We need developers willing to build new housing that requires an environment where projects remain financially viable, Moore said. If builders and investors do not see a reasonable return on investment, fewer housing projects will move forward, which ultimately means fewer homes for Massachusetts residents. And we all know supply and demand. If there's less of a supply, what happens to the cost of that housing? Small Property Owners Association President Amir Shashsavari said that costs rose during the pandemic and haven't gone down. He said, on average, for property owners, utilities costs are up about 39%. Property insurance is up 25 to 40%. Property taxes are up 21%. And supplies for repairs and maintenance are up roughly 30%. Energy costs, mortgage payments, and interests have also risen. When you have a policy where rents would be capped at 5% or CPI, whichever is lower, and CPI is typically somewhere in the 2 to 2.5% range, that's not enough for us to keep up with expenses. And therefore, housing falls into disrepair and problems ensue for both tenants, owners, and other stakeholders, Shashsavari said. Somerville's Jelen has proposed local option rent control for her district for years. The stories are real, she told opponents. Your first point is correct, I believe. Not every community is the same. One size doesn't fit all. But we are desperate in Somerville and in many other places. The people from Homes for All are willing to find out if there's a space where you would protect potential homebuyers and renters against displacement and being outbid by large developers, very, very large developers, who will come in with cash and no conditions before the place is on the market. Is there any space to negotiate? Jelen asked. Quattrochi replied that whether the petition is local option or not is a huge issue, but that he sees the main issue being compensation. He said some landlords participate in programs like the Section 8 housing program, which he said is successful because it recognizes that housing has to be paid for. If the city of Somerville or anyone else wants to allocate an amount, like you allocate for your teachers, to a kind of rent control system that is, in effect, rental assistance, yes, that makes a lot of sense to work together for, he said. But as I said before, housing isn't free, and somehow the cost of it has to be covered. Asked if the landlords are advocating for a negotiation with lawmakers, Quattrochi said, at this point, it's kind of too late. It's going to the ballot. Mass Landlords has advocated for a compensation form of rent control as an alternative. Units countered, we're going to defeat this in November, and we're going to do it through the small property owners like these folks here. The SJC case is ongoing. The court says most cases are generally decided within 130 days of oral arguments. Justices typically move more quickly on cases that involve ballot questions. Following nearly a year and a half of squabbling between Auditor Diana DiZoglio and Attorney General Andrea Campbell, there's been movement in DiZoglio's attempt to audit the legislature, and already the wrangling over future document requests and audit demands is heating up. Campbell said Tuesday she would allow DiZoglio to secure outside counsel to bring a lawsuit against the legislature for failure to respond to four specific document requests that the court identified in an order issued last week. Campbell asked DiZoglio to agree by May 18th to voluntarily dismiss the suit she brought against House Speaker Ronald Mariano and Senate President Karen Spilka in February, so a new complaint can take its place. DiZoglio's office said Wednesday its lawyers would soon review Campbell's procedural requests. In her own response, DiZoglio claimed that Campbell had tried to box us in with comments she made on GBH radio on Tuesday, repeatedly saying that the Supreme Judicial Court had cleared an avenue for DiZoglio to pursue action on just the four topics specifically mentioned in the court's order. DiZoglio, who is pursuing a second four-year term this year, said nothing in the order of the case limits her ability to request additional documents from the legislature in the future. "We are not going to ask the legislature for a few records, call it an audit, and tell the taxpayers that's all they get because the Attorney General's public comments sought to box us in," DiZoglio said in a statement. The current legal dispute only correctly considers requests made associated with this current litigation, but in no way limits our office from requesting additional documents and records needed for our audit work outside of this legal case and in accordance with the law. When the court discussed limits to particular records right now, they were clear over and over, as we were, that these limits are only in the context of this particular legal case, referencing January 2025 requests, but do not hinder our ability to request additional records needed to complete our audit work, or sue, moving forward, after this specific legal case is resolved. During her Tuesday appearance on JBH Radio, Campbell agreed under pressure from co-host Jim Broad that DiZoglio is not automatically barred by the court's order from pursuing an audit of other legislative matters at a later date. "I want to be careful here, because right now we have four things, and the audit as defined by the court order is limited to those four things. If she wants to bring something up later, the court will have to play a role in that too, because it will depend, is it constitutional or not," Campbell said. "So we will visit that when it comes. But I know this, on this order right now, from Thursday, and these four things that we are specific, we'll move forward." Last week, DiZoglio told reporters that the four audit topics she laid out in the January 2025 memo were chosen specifically in an attempt to avoid a constitutional clash. She said she originally wanted to revisit all of the issues she sought to review in the unsuccessful legislative audit she launched before voters gave her that explicit power. "However, after speaking with staff counsel in the Attorney General's office, we agreed very early on, back in January of 2025, to limit this particular audit to the issues mentioned in that letter, so as to prevent even the potential for a constitutional debate that, if we delved into other areas, might actually ensue at some point in the hypothetical future," she said after the SJC heard the case. The four document requests that Campbell has cleared DiZoglio to pursue cover the official budgets for each chamber of the legislature for fiscal years 2021, 2022, 2023, and 2024, copies of official audits of each chamber for the same fiscal years, a listing of all transactions related to each chamber's balance forward line item for those fiscal years, and a list of all monetary settlement agreements entered into by each chamber with any current or former employees or elected members during the same time frame. Future audit attempts could revive debate over the question of constitutional separations of power and whether the legislature's right to govern its own affairs limits the auditor's power to demand documents from it. That question has been a constant in back and forth between DiZoglio and Campbell to this point. Campbell's office said in its Tuesday letter to DiZoglio that the auditor's office has not defined its position on the issue of constitutional limits on its audit authority. First Assistant Attorney General Pat Moore wrote that Campbell's office will not undertake to define the Office of the State Auditor's position for it, nor will we litigate the issue for the OSA. Moore said Campbell's office made its position on the scope of legislative privilege clear in correspondence with DiZoglio's office, and also in a filing it made in a case last year that involved former Senator Dean Tran. In that case, Campbell's office argued that the so-called speech and debate clause of Article 21 of the Declaration of Rights does not protect members of the legislature from prosecution for acts that fall outside the legislative sphere or render such members exempt from ordinary criminal laws. You've been listening to an episode of the Massachusetts State House News Service, a program produced by Audio Journal and sponsored by the Memorial Foundation for the Blind and the Massachusetts Commission for the Blind. This is Paula Simchak. Thank you for listening. Stay tuned for more informative programming by Audio Journal.